Thank you, David. It's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to see David Flaherty here. We miss him a lot in the UK, but having visited Portugal now, I think, you know, I see the good reasons why he decided to settle here. So I am going to talk about emergence from a slightly different perspective from the ones that have been taken in the previous 2 days. So I'm going to talk as a metaphysician, and as a metaphysician interested in the history of metaphysics. And although emergence sounds like a very modern kind of debate, I want to say that it is a debate, or it's not a debate. It is something that ancient thinkers were thinking about already. So what I'm going to do is not give you an historical type of talk. I'm not proposing any Greek interpretation of the text. I just want to tell you a bit about how Plato, I think, introduced emergence into something that is definitely not known, I think. If we think of anybody having the concept of emergence, we think of Aristotle. But I want to say Plato is the first who introduces the idea for particular reasons that have to do with his metaphysics of form. So I'm going to kind of give you his motivations for thinking of the concept of emergence, and I'm going to argue for which kind of emergence I think Plato has introduced, and contrast that to the one that is a bit more familiar from antiquity, that of Aristotle, and try to bring out which are the metaphysical features of Plato's account of emergence that are different from the ones other ancient philosophers, but also other contemporary philosophers are thinking about. So I want to show it as a distinctive way of thinking about emergence. I've not taken the further step to try to see whether it is applicable to certain emergence that we nowadays worry about, but there may be heuristic potential in this way of thinking of Plato. So that's future work. So to talk to you about Plato on emergence, I necessarily need to give you a little bit of background about Plato's system. So some of you will be very familiar with it, some perhaps less, but I'll keep it pretty minimal. So what matters to us for present purposes is that Plato's ontology is pretty simple, pretty neat, we could say. So it includes individuals, which are sensible objects like Amanda, the chair, the computer, the bottle of water. Forms, which are abstract properties, hot, red, but also justice and beauty. And participation, that is, one feature of Plato's system that we find very interesting but problematic as well. Participation is the mechanism by which sensible objects in the world get qualified by properties. Now, participation, that is the mechanism by which sensible objects get qualified by properties, works like this, or at least so I argue, because of course it's a very controversial topic. Sensible things get qualified by properties parts of the form that stand for that property within their own constitution. So I'll just say it again, a particular object possesses the property. What if that object has within its constitution a part of the form? That's quite interesting. I interpret that as a sort of constitutional overlap. So the object in the world and the form overlap constitutionally in that they share a part. There is something that is a part of the object and a part of the form that is shared when the object has the property that the form stands for. And I've argued this at length in my new book manuscript, so I'm not going to say more, but if you find it intriguing, I'm happy to talk more about it. On this understanding of property qualifications, properties are treated as constituents of things. So they are part of the constitution of sensible objects. That's in itself very interesting, considering that properties are abstract entities and objects are tangible things in the world. But let this be for the time being. How about forms? So forms is what we're going to concentrate on, because forms are what set the metaphysical requirements, I argue, that lead Plato to posit or to discover emergence. So I put on the slide the three features of the metaphysics of form that are relevant to with respect to leading Plato to discover emergence. So forms, and all this is my interpretation, so I want to say you probably have heard other ways of thinking about the forms. It's a disclaimer. This is how I think of them. I've argued for them in the new book. here is the summary of it. Forms are such that the presence of a part of a form in an object qualifies the object with the property the form stands for. So let's say, simple example, X is hot because it partakes of the form hot. So X is hot because there is a part of the form hot in the constitutional X. Secondly, forms for Plato are incomposite because he posits them to be indestructible and eternal, and he thinks, we might disagree, that composite entities may be decomposed and perish. So if the forms were composite, there would be something to destructibility, and that doesn't fit with the Plato gives an argument for that in the Phaedo. Thirdly, forms are qualitatively simple or indifferentiated in their constitution. And the motivation for that is that each form qualifies its partaker with one property only. So if the form, let's say hot, was not qualitatively simple, not qualitatively indifferentiated, the thing that partakes in that form by having a part of that form within its constitution would be qualified in multiple ways. And it's only the qualitative simplicity of the form that secures that for something partaking in a form, that something is qualified in only one way. So these are basically assumptions that I'm making here that have to do with Plato's theory of forms. And I will show how these assumptions lead him to think about emergence. So what's interesting is that the first two assumptions clash with each other. So the forms are constituted of parts. The parts are in the individuals here, but they're also incomposite, have to do with composite. So prima facie, this looks like a conundrum. What does that mean? How can this be? Is Plato playing, contradicting himself? Plato certainly is exercised by this issue, and he explores in a famous passage in the dialogue called Theaetetus, in the passage that is known in the literature as the dilemma of composition, the constitution of composites. So his example there is a syllable and its letters. But what, you know, the general investigation there is about the relation between plurality, totality, and whole parts. So one achievement already of Plato is to conceptually differentiate these three types of complexes or composites and try to investigate the relation of complex things to their components of parts. So Plato considers whether a complex thing is identical to the plurality of its parts or the totality of its parts or the whole, and whether and how plurality, totality, and the whole differ from each other and from the resulting complex thing, if they're not identical to it. So this kind of exercise in mereology that Plato undertakes, and you know, we'll look into it a little bit more. The point is that that is interesting to us is that the outcome of this investigation in kinds of mereological compositions is that Plato, and here is my thesis, is thus allowed to discover emergence, because neither of the accounts of mereological compositions that he, the composition that he has looked at in the dilemma, deliver what he needs for the forms. So he's led to innovate there, to go beyond these accounts of mereological composition. And he concludes the dilemma with a conclusion that sounds surprising, namely that there must be a complex entity that is different from plurality, totality, and whole, whose emergent form is incomposite, namely partless, and in this respect novel in relation to its base, partitioned and qualitative simple. So basically, at the end of the dilemma of composition, Plato gets to this stance that there is, that given a certain base, a certain group of components, there is an emergent form that is incomposite, partitioned, and qualitative simple. And that is exactly the metaphysics that you would like to have for his form in general. Now, I want to argue that in this brief argument in the Theaetetus, Plato actually pioneers metaphysically a conception of forms as emergent fusions of their parts. So here is now this interpretive work that I'm doing myself. He's thinking of forms, of this emergent form with the characteristics I just gave you as a fusion of its parts, where the fusion here is to be understood in a logical sense, or meteorological sense, not as a physical fusion of the parts. And I want to argue more broadly that his concept of fusion in relation to the forms combined with partaking understood as constitutional overlap can give Plato the ontology of forms and of partaking that he needs for his system to work. And I want to emphasize that it is a breakthrough. So we're not very familiar with concepts like fusion and overlap and so on and so forth. But when we look at the ancients, you know, they pioneering these ideas. So I think this is a breakthrough of Plato, and not just because he introduces thereby emergence in the history of philosophy. So we didn't have it before Plato, although we're familiar with it now. He introduces emergence, but introduces a distinct type of emergence that is different, for example, from that of Aristotle. So one take-home message of my talk today is that we have at least two different models for emergence in antiquity. The one a bit more known is that of Aristotle. The one not known at all is that of Plato, and the one of Plato is worthwhile investigating. So I will start developing my argument, and I will sort of speed through some parts that might be a bit more of historical interest and concentrate more on the parts that are of philosophical interest. But I also want to show you how the reasoning of Plato proceeds. So I want to show you what kind of work does someone like me need to do to extract from the text these philosophical ideas, because of course ancient texts do not give us, you know, the language and the line of thinking in the way we are used to have it. So I want to start literally from Plato, partly also because that will give you evidence that you can use to assess whether the interpretation I'm giving you seems sound or not. So it's a way of like giving you also the means, enabling you to then check what you think about how I interpret this. Passages of Plato. So I said that it all begins for Plato with the dilemma of composition. That's a text in the Theaetetus where Plato considers three possible accounts of the ontology of complex entities. So one we could just for short call it David Lewis' account, okay? So, the variety is identical to the totality, the identical to the whole of parts. The second, the whole of parts is different from the plurality, which is identical to the totality. So plurality and totality are one and the same thing. We can refer to the football team using a singular verb or a verb in the plural. Nothing changes in the ontology there. They are the same entities, but they are different from the whole of those entities taken together. And account three, as I say, is the one that is surprising. It's the one that, according to Plato, has the complex thing being all there is, arising out of parts, but having no parts. And that's the one I will dig a bit more into. So accounts one and two define a complex in terms of its parts. So the, you know, there are differences between one and two, but the main thing that is matters to us is that they define the complex in terms of its parts. So they cannot serve for Plato to explain the constitution of forms, which are supposed to be incomposite. Account three introduces a new idea, that is this idea of a complex thing that arises out of parts but has no parts. And that's and what is important here is that this conception of mineralogical composition introduces unity in the sense of continuity, rather than interconnectedness of parts. So accounts one and two were still playing with unity derived from putting parts together with some connections between them. But account three introduces the idea that unity is, in some sense, continuity, so dissolution of the borders, if you want, of the parts, rather than interconnectedness of the parts. And to get to that type of unity that is described in this stance, a complex thing arises out of parts but has no parts, the passage there from parts to having no parts is emergence. There is something, there are parts from which a new entity emerges that is partless, and that is novelty in relation to the base. So here, you know, it's an understanding of novelty that is different from some modern understanding where it's causal powers that mark the novelty of the emergent entity. Is a kind of different type of novelty. The novelty is in the partlessness of what emerges. But how does Plato get to that? So here, these are actually a few lines from Plato, very few lines, but immensely rich if you just glance at them. So this is a dialogue between Socrates and Theaetetus. I'll just quickly read it out. So Socrates says, according to what you're saying now, Theaetetus, a complex would be some absolute kind of thing, not divisible into parts. And Theaetetus says, apparently, i.e. yes. And Socrates says, and now the complex has fallen into the same class as the element, given that it is indivisible and is a single kind of thing. Yes, says Theaetetus. And Socrates comments, it's a single thing without parts. So you see how rich this passage is. It's quite clear that we go from parts to something that emerges from parts, and it emerges from parts in the sense it is novel from the parts from which it emerges from, because it's partless. But what we don't get in that passage from Plato is any explanation of how this is the case. We don't get the metaphysics for it. We just get the statement that we go from parts to something that is partless. And Plato struggles with this mechanism. So he doesn't have it in his pocket, right? And here it is. He tries different ways to account metaphysically for the emergence of something that is partless from parts. And what I've done is to try to track the ways Plato tries to explain this emergent entity that is partless. And I've been looking at ways in which Plato describes the metaphysics of oneness and the simplicity of a complex. And I've identified three ways he tries to do that. So these are fit, holism, and fusion. So these are modern terms, but and they're not, if you ask me, there is no Greek word corresponding to them, but there are passages in Plato where the description is very much corresponding to these metaphysical theories. So fit might seem to us a non-starter, right? But Plato starts from there. You have to think again, you know, he's just pioneering these ideas. So in the fit model, the elements that compose into one thing fit together, like bricks making up a wall, or letters, like the letter epsilon and the letter upsilon in the first syllable of the word eureka. And Plato's little passage talking just about that. And you see that he thinks that the fitting together should deliver having no parts, but doesn't work as such. Because the elements that fit together remain numerically discrete. I think that's a problem, that fitting is just not enough because it doesn't undermine the numerical discreteness of the parts. So Plato proceeds exploring another alternative, holism. Now, I need to say, there is nowhere a passage where Plato says, there is holism, and I'll just give you a description. But Plato gives examples, and so I selected a couple of them. So he talks about the face and its parts. So he thinks that the parts of the face are defined in relation to the face as a whole. They are what they are in relation to the face as a whole. And then he has a more complex example about a syllable, P-H-T, in Greek. So this syllable appears in different names, and to really know the syllable, you need to know how to spell it whenever it occurs in different names. So if you know how to spell it when it occurs in the name Theodorus, but you don't know how to spell it when it occurs in the name Theaetetus, you just don't know it. And that shows us that Plato is thinking that knowledge of the syllable has to be holistic, so taking into account the relations within which the syllable is embedded. But these are just examples. The point that I want to make is that the examples indicate that Plato does have some understanding of holistic dependence, the dependence of what the part is on the whole, of which the part is a part. In the case of the parts of the face, or in the case of the knowledge of the syllable. But Plato does not develop a metaphysical account of holism. He has no articulation of this idea that the part has to be redefined in terms of the whole in a holistic whole. He doesn't have it as such. It is Aristotle who develops it later. Famously with the homonymy principle. I'm sure you all are familiar with it. It's very simply a finger is not in any situation a finger, but only when attached to the hand, because only then it can perform the function of being a finger. So if you detach a finger from the hand, you just get a different type of entity. that has changed criteria of individuation outside the whole. So that is Aristotle, but that's not is not Plato. And there is evidence that Plato thinks that holism was not the right way to get to this emergent partless entity that is after. Again, in the Dilemma of Composition, Plato rejects explicitly the holistic possible solution. It says it would be ridiculous to think that you know, there is something that emerges as partless by having something other than the letter themselves being part of it, namely something that gets re-identified. So we have evidence that Plato has some understanding of holism, enough understanding that he does not like it as a solution for getting to his emergent partless entity. But already here we saw that there are these two conceptions in antiquity. One is Aristotle's, the one that we all take by default when we think about ancient metaphysics as a prominent one, and a different one, which is the one that Plato comes to, that is fusion. So after having tried fit and holism, Plato tries fusion. Fusion is what he wants, a logical fusion, I mean, here. Fusion is what he wants for having an emergent entity that is partless and thus continuous. So now we think of the emergent form that is one as the fusion of all the parts of the form that are insensible individuals in the world, plus any other part that the form might have that could get, might get partitioned into when more individuals partake in it. But now, as I give fusion as the solution, as what Plato needs to get to this emergent partless entity that his forms need to be, I also immediately want to flag that there is an open issue. Because, okay, suppose that we think of all the parts of the form that there are in, you know, all the people in this room, according to Plato, will be human beings because in each of us, there is a part of the form being a human being. So lots of parts here. What is the form being a human being? It's an emergent entity that is the fusion of all the parts of human being that are in the world. Now, why is this good but not the whole story that Plato should give us? Well, because how about when a newborn baby, maybe us baby, comes into the world, you know, which part does she get? You know, what happens? You know, in other words, thinking of the some of the existing parts of the forms in the world now as the fusion, that is the emergent partless entity, is okay for the state of the world as it is now, but does not tell us what happens when, for example, an individual goes out of existence or a new individual comes into existence and therefore they get new parts from that fusion. There is like fresh partitioning that still can take place because we know that the world is in flux, in change. So I argue that Plato has thought about this problem when he talks in relation to the form of beauty. A lovely kind of example, let a thousand more beautiful flowers come in the world and, you know, beauty will be untouched. It will not become less just because there are more beautiful women, more beautiful flowers, more beautiful works of art. Beauty will remain untouched. It will change. It will be no less and no more just because there are more individuals with a part of beauty in them. So you see the sort of, it gets a bit puzzling, but there is a point that we want to retain from this example of beauty, a general point that forms do not change when objects in the world partake or cease to partake in them. So Plato has to do some more work. It's not enough to say that the form of beauty is one and is partless because it emerges from the fusion of all the existing parts now of the form in the world. That's not enough. He also has to say what happens when new individuals come to have a part, so a new part is generated, or some individuals cease to have a part, so maybe that part ceases to be. What happens then? How is it that it's like carving out more parts of the form, or leaving some parts of the form does not change the form? And here I think I want to say that I think Plato is thinking of a concept that we could labeled Cambridge partitioning. So, you know, I'm sorry for all of us who feel a bond with Oxford, but Cambridge wins the game, I think, on this one. that here is the thought. When a particular overlaps with a form and shares a part of the form within its constitution, there is no increase or decrease of the form. Okay, so overlap does not make a difference to the form increasing or decreasing. But the question is, how about a new individual partaking of the form? Does that partition the form once one extra time and therefore changes the form? So that's the question that I'm considering. And here is the argument or the answer I want to give. Well, Plato must be thinking that the partitioning that the individuals in the world operate on the form is like Cambridge change. Let's call it Cambridge partitioning. So it's like as if external or extrinsic to the form, and it doesn't change the form that that is partitioned. So Cambridge partitioning does not partition an object, namely the form, as much as Cambridge change does not change an object. So forms, I think as Plato thinks of them, are internally fusions, but externally undivided, because no partaking from the individuals in the world makes a difference to them, at least in the sense that it's just merely a Cambridge type of partaking. So far, so good if you embrace the argument I've given you with respect to how is it that the forms can be partless but also partitioned. So that conundrum that I highlighted in the beginning. So Plato wants the forms to be having parts such that things that have a part of the form are qualified by that part, but also wants the form to be incomposite. And I think what we've seen, namely the idea of the form as an internal fusion of the parts plus subject to Cambridge partition on the part of the object in the world, delivers that part of the theory that Plato wants. But if you remember, I had as a third feature of the forms as Plato wants them, their qualitative uniformity, their, it's here. So forms are qualitative simple, and there is a reason for that. If they were no if they weren't simple, they wouldn't transmit a single property to objects in the world. So that's quite important within the theory. So how does Plato do that? What metaphysics can he use to explain qualitative uniformity? Now, what's interesting is that this qualitative uniformity of the form is not in any way required by fusion. So you could fuse things that are qualitatively different. In fact, that's how we think very physical fusion very much like that. What is it that secures the qualitative uniformity of the form has to be something extra, something different. And I think it's the principle of Plato that, again, has been quite controversial, but it's the principle of self-predication of the forms. So the forms embody the properties that they stand for. So the form of beauty is beautiful, for example. The form of red is red. Sorry, form of human being is human being. So forms embody the properties they stand for. That is the principle of self-predication. And that, if that is the case, then we get this qualitative uniformity of the fusion, because everything is embodying the property the form stands for. So the form as an emergent entity, and all the parts of the form from which the form as an emergent entity emerges are all qualified by the property the form stands for, and that's what secures qualitative uniformity. Here I casted the problem with a little bit of extra jargon, namely that forms for Plato are homoiomeric. That's a Greek term to say that there are things whose parts are of the same kind as the whole. It's like water, as the ancients understood it, is homoiomeric, because all the parts of water are water. But the human being is not homoiomeric, because not all the parts of a human being are a human being. That's terminology. I gave you the idea. One more step. Remember that Plato was saying that the forms, the emergent form from parts of the form is indivisible and a single kind of thing. So it's a single kind of thing because it's qualitatively uniform, because of the self-predication principle. But in what sense it is indivisible? What kind of indivisibility is in place? union than being simply qualitatively uniform or indifferentiated. It's stricter than having no parts and stricter than being qualitatively uniform, as I say. So, and that too cannot be delivered just by saying that the forms are fusion. So how is it that Plato works it out? I think the brilliant idea of Plato here is to discover that there are syncategorematic properties even before Aristotle put categories, I think, categorematic properties. So he's basically thinking that there are some qualifications that we may give to the forms that count as categorematic properties, and therefore they don't add complexity to the being of the forms, and therefore they don't in any way undermine the simplicity in the strong sense of indivisibility of the nature of the forms. It is a bit, I'm happy to go quickly on, because it's probably not so crucial to our thinking about emergence, but I was very surprised by it when I came to think about it, that it could be that Plato is now here thinking of syncategorematic properties. So I just wanted to register it as an interesting thought of Plato. So if all good so far, we have the metaphysics of forms, just as Plato wanted it, with forms emerging from the their parts, where the emergent form is incomposite, and that is, the emergent form is incomposite because it's a fusion of its parts, is qualitatively simple, that is by self-predication, and it is Cambridge partition. So whenever something in the world partakes or ceases to partake in that form, it's a change of the kind of that we identify as Cambridge change. Now, it is not, however, the end of the story, although it's probably approaching the end of my time. There is one more thought I want to discuss with you that I think is something that I've been thinking about in relation to Plato and Aristotle, but I think it really can make a contribution to contemporary thinking about emergence. So it seems to me that many nowadays think that an emergent state ipso facto gives rise to an emergent individual. That's something we read often in the literature. So, you know, most of you are definitely more experts on emergence than myself, so I'm happy to hear what thoughts there are from the audience. But I've read this many times, maybe not exactly in these words, but to the fact that, you know, the emergent state ipso facto gives rise to an emergent individual. And I put on the slide just one example from Michael Ashfield, and there are many others, but and this is an older work of Michael, but where he gives the example of a quantum state of an entangled system, where the entangled state is talked of as being one individual with parts that are holistically determined by the singlet state that describes the whole. And I want to resist this idea, and you know, I keenly look at you all. I want to resist this idea that an emergent state is ipso facto an emergent individual. And I want to at least contribute to this question, which is an open question for me, with what I've myself seen in Plato and Aristotle. So certainly for Aristotle, it looks as if Plato and Aristotle assumes, like we modern assume, that emergence delivers oneness. So the emergent state is an individual, okay? It might seem that way. Many think that way in the literature on Aristotle, for example. And I've argued somewhere in my work on Aristotle that this is not the case. I've proven that emergence by holism does not deliver the oneness of the emergent entity. But so emergence by holism unifies but does not quantify the number of the emergent entities. So that's work I've done on Aristotle. And thinking about Plato, I've been asking myself the question, so does for Plato the emergent entity come with a number one, attached to it? And it might seem so. His words seem to suggest that, so that's why I put them up again. Plato seems to move freely from an absolute kind of thing, single kind of thing, to a single thing. So as if the emergent state delivers the unified entity. So I've been intrigued by this, and I've been thinking a bit more about the question. So is emergence by fusion an exception to what I think should be a general rule that whatever emerges is an emergent state, but not necessarily ipso facto an emergent entity. Does emergence by fusion determine the number of what emerges? And my answer is, I believe not. Emergence of any kind, whether it is by holism or by fusion, does not of its own determine the number of the emergent. Emergence of any type only unifies, but unification is not the same as giving something a number, determining the number of a thing. So you can have things that are unified, and yet it's an open question whether they're one or many. Then it's a further question of how we address the question of whether that thing is one of many. So many bees or one swarm, swarm of bees. The reason why I'm offering this thought is that it seems to me that number is grounded on difference, but difference is not wiped out by the unity of emergence. And that's why I think the question of number is still open. So what I put up on the slide now is my intuition in defense of what I'm saying. So my intuition is that the number we give to something is grounded on difference. And it would be wrong to think that emergence, by unifying the base in some way, in some novel ways, wipes out the differences that characterize the base. And that's why I think it is not true that emergent entity gets determined numerically just by the fact that it's emergent. So if what you're thinking is true, at least I want to say, I think I have some degree of confidence in saying this, that emergent by fusion and emergent by holism do not determine the number of the emergent entity. And my general suspicion is that that should be true for any kind of emergence, on which I asked your expert views. And I come briefly to the conclusion, hoping I'm not overdoing my time. What I've been trying to argue here on the basis of thinking about Plato is that emergence is a novel type of unification of the base elements. And at least in ancient metaphysics, and this may be true more generally in metaphysics, I think we can distinguish two ways of unifying by emergence the base into something that is novel. And these two ways are the following. On one way, it is the discreteness of the base elements that gets eliminated. So it has to do with which elements there are in the base. And that is number one. Number two is abandoning the essence of the base elements. So let me explain them. The first one corresponds to fusion. So basically eliminating the discreteness of the elements that compose is the fusion way. So what happens there is like the boundaries, that ground the numerical difference among the elements get kind of torn down. But that doesn't do anything to the what it is of the elements. The second way, the holism way of Aristotle, operates on what it is that the elements are. So the elements in a holistic composite are re-identified. They come to be something different from what they were by being re-identified by holism. And that is a different operation that has not to do with their discrete number, but with their essence. So I think these are two ways that we can emergence can unify and generate a novel, novel unified state. Plato and Aristotle are representative of these two ways. Neither type of emergence determine the number of the emergent entity. And that's just bringing you back to Plato. I think what Plato shows us with his thinking about these topics is that mereology, in a way, is dealing with the unities of parts. So that's all he's thinking about aggregate totality called Cambridge partitioning. Well, emergence has to do with the unity of the continuum. So that at this point, I come to the conclusion of my talk, but I also want to say this is direction for future work. So what else can we extract from the thinking of Plato and Aristotle in comparison, contrast to each other in relation to mereology and emergence? I believe Plato is the first to give us a model of emergence as fusion, and the model of emergence as fusion different from modern ones, and also different from that of Aristotle, which is emergence by holism. And then I believe Plato's given us lots of lines to pursue, including that we need to think about how we go from emergence to the number of the emergent entity, which I think remains an open question. So thank you very much.